Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This podcast is part of the How We Are Network. For information on this episode and many other like-minded shows, visit howweare.org. That's howweare.org.
Greetings, one and all. I am your host, Ray Harkins, and I find myself getting really loud, and then as the talk goes on, I start to get a little more quieter. I think it's just kind of a instinctual thing to yell at you first to get your attention, and then I kind of ease off, and we start talking in a normal voice. So I'm your host, Ray Harkins. You are at 100 Words or Less, the podcast. The guest this week, continuing with our theme in the month of June, which is basically luminaries within the context of the punk and hardcore scene. These are people who are basically what I define as ahead of the curve. So these are people that created really compelling music, are still active in some capacity, and are just really interesting people. So it just happened to sync up where I talked to a lot of these people, and the schedules worked out. So you are benefiting from that. Anyways, the guest this week is Dave Verillen. He is the vocalist for a band, a little band you may have heard called Botch, which is awesome that the band is still so readily mentioned within the context of heavy music, because progressive is an understatement. They really, really push the boundaries of what heavy music should be like, and yeah. Great stuff. Anyways, more on him in a minute. And let's get some business out of the way. So for those of you who contributed in the fundraising campaign, I'm here to thank you. That is my job, because you have decided that you want to pitch in some money on a monthly basis, and I appreciate that. So two people I want to highlight. One of them is a close friend of mine, Corey Finneran. He lives in the Midwest, does a great baseball podcast called Ivy Envy. And if you like the Chicago Cubs, you should go check that out. But yeah, shout out to him. Love him. Great dude. Great family. I love people. And he is one of them. And then Melissa Schuler. I could be mispronouncing your name. And if I do, I apologize. But I don't know you. And the fact that you listen to the show is absolutely incredible. I love that. So you should email me, because you know I want to have that direct feedback and correlation of the people who are supporting the show. So thank you to both of you. because you are great, and your fun stickers and buttons and stuff are in the mail soon. And for those of you that are still interested in donating to the show, visit 100 Words Podcast, and on the right side you can see donate to the show. So pop on there. I'm still offering rewards, fun stuff. I can interview you for an upcoming episode, send you a bonus episode where I talk about all of the highlights and greatest hits and untold stories. So yeah, visit there. Visit propertyofzach.com, our great media partners, and email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. Now we have a contributor to the show. For those of you that checked this out, I would say about a month or so ago. So there's an amazing website called the AV Club. And they are, as far as I'm concerned, they are my destination for anything pop culture, music, TV, film. They cover it all. They do it in a unique voice. Incredible. And my friend, Dave Anthony, works there. He is like the digital manager of something cool over there. So he's been a fan of the show for a long time, has supported the show. And I asked him if he would probably once a month contribute some records. So basically, here's some recommendations, stuff that myself and Dave have been listening to, and you should check out as well. So here's a little conversation, and I'll be with you in a minute.
Well, I mean, I recommended this split LP kind of thing called Released from Love, which is a collaboration between a band called Thou and a band called The Body, who are both, you know, kind of sludgy, doomy metal bands who've been around for a little while. You know, Thou kind of got a lot of hype, and a lot of people are into them just because, you know, they're really prolific, do a lot of DIY touring, and the records are awesome. And The Body is, you know, kind of similar, but they also put out a record this year called I Shall Die Here, which is a collaboration with the Hacks and Cloak, which is more like electronic kind of stuff. And it's just really weird, like quasi-industrial stuff. But this split, I saw Vinyl Rights was putting it out, and like just bought it, you know, kind of on the strength of both bands' back catalogs. And I really like a split where it's not like, oh, here's, you know, this band's song, now this band's song. Like, they work together on the songs. And I just always like when bands do that. Like, one of my favorite splits ever is the Casket Lottery Smaller on Bike split, for that very reason.
Yeah. I was going to mention the same exact thing, where it's like, anytime you see a split, it's like, okay, that's cool because two like-minded bands. But when they actually legitimately get in the same room and write stuff together and work off one another, it's like, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, for years, that like Small Run by Casket Lottery split has been like a huge reference point for me, because I think it's, not only is it some of the best individual songs, like Wrong Hometown, which is like everyone kind of working together, is maybe the best song either of those bands ever wrote. And I love both those bands. And then the fucking David Bowie Queen cover of Under Pressure is just so spot on. Like, it's so lovingly recreated, and yeah, you need two bands to do that. Like, no one band could be like, oh, we're gonna fucking do Under Pressure and do it well.
On tape, you can audibly hear how much fun they're having.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where it's like just so joyous. It's just two bands who are friends doing something amazing and really bigger than themselves, but just doing it because they love to do it. It didn't matter. They just went for it, and it was a success. And that's kind of what the impetus for picking up Release from Love was for me, is that, like, all right, I like both these bands. Yeah, I was always more partial to Thou, but, you know, I like some of the Body stuff. And I heard this record, and it just fucking flattened me. It was incredible. I mean, it's so heavy. That first song on it, The Wheel Weaves as the Wheel Wills, like, that's just, it's what I love about really heavy and aggressive music, where it's super distorted, everything's super huge, but it feels so expressive. Mm-hmm. And the way the vocals play off one another, you know, because the singer from The Body has a much, like, higher pitch, like, quasi-black metal shriek kind of.
Yeah.
And the way that plays off, like, you know, like, this, like, very doomy music, I think makes it really unique. And the choice to close the album with that Vic Chestnut cover is fucking so bold to me, because I'm a big Vic Chestnut fan, and like the end of his life and really most of his story is so tragic. And it's cool to see heavy, you know, metal bands like referencing something that's so slight and quiet and restrained and doing it justice and still doing it their own way.
It's funny because like when you recommended it to check out, I'm aware of both bands. I've listened to Thou, haven't really listened to The Body. Thou never hit me. I was just like, yeah, they're okay. Like, it was just one of those bands that kind of fell into the, you know, just the void for me.
Yeah.
And to have this affect me as deeply as it did for bands that I, like, to be frank, I just didn't really care about. It was so, that's, and I guess that was so, what was so exciting for me to have that ignited, where it was like, dude, this is exactly why I like the heavy, dark music of, you know, Iron Monkey, I Hate God, like everything that flips my switch with those is completely entwined with this. But these are just like, you know, they're doing it, obviously, like you said, with all of those reference points of what's happening currently without sounding like this. Oh, yeah, you guys are that's cute. You're trying to imitate what happened before you, but they're like totally not at the same time.
No, yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what draws me in about it is that, you know, they, you have these obvious reference points, the I Hate God being a really good one, and but it still feels like they're doing something unto themselves. Like, I like doom and sludge and that kind of stuff, but it's a very tempered experience for me. Like, unless a band really sticks out, I'm like, oh, that's cool, and then I just kind of forget about it. Like, this record, you know, like, grabbed me by the throat and was like, you are going to be obsessed with this for the next month. And it, yeah, that obsession's still going.
I have to interject and say that the I can't recall the last time that I just had that page open. And I mean, upon like the third or fourth listen, I was like, okay, I need to immediately buy the vinyl, which I did. But then I was like, I can't wait for it to get here. I'm just going to constantly stream these songs on SoundCloud.
Well, that's the cool thing about it too, is Vinyl Rights, like, they're ostensibly a vinyl only label. And like, one, the record sounds great. But like, that one stream that is just kind of floating around on SoundCloud is like the only digital version, aside from probably some like shitty vinyl rips. So, like, I kind of like the idea of this being, like, you know, if that stream ever gets taken down, like, this is ostensibly, at least for a little while, like, a vinyl-only release. It's just, like, two bands who wanted to do something together, and, you know, 5-10 years from now, like, this could be a weird collector's item, but it's one of those things where, to me, it's so important right now, and I think, you know, it's still early in the year, but it is one of my favorite heavy releases of this year. And I'm stoked that it hit you in the same way, because for a minute I was just like, why does no one else care about this?
Yeah, it totally did. And it really hit me in ways that honestly, like, heavy music, it has to do a lot now for me to really like becoming that engaged with it. And when I say heavy, I mean like this extreme heavy, not just like, oh yeah, like, you know, whatever, your typical sort of whatever hardcore metal stuff can still affect me. But this type of stuff, definitely, it has to be really good, you know, and this is exactly what it was.
Well, I'm glad you dig it. But it's kind of funny, because I guess we can kind of switch into your record now. But there's a correlation I wanted to bring up, or something I've noticed with like metal bands. I feel like, you know, a lot of times they get not necessarily across the board, but a lot of times they get better as they age, as they, you know, get a little better at their instruments, kind of really nail down their sound, get better equipment. Like, in metal, it's really common that everyone's like, oh, like, that band's like third, fourth, fifth album is the best album. Whereas like punk and hardcore, it's like people love, generally speaking, like the first or second record. Like, most hardcore bands don't make three records. And if they do, people are like, oh, it's not as good as the early shit.
Right.
So I guess that kind of sets up, why did you choose the Bane record then?
Yeah, I chose the Bane record, which is called Don't Wait Up, which is, you know, as anybody that pays attention to the band realizes, it's their last record. Like I said over email, like, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about it, because, I mean, Bane for me, and I know a lot of other people, is a very formative band. Like, you know, when you first started to get into hardcore, it was like an easy touch point to kind of launch you into, you know, other bands of that same genre, just because they were usually on tour. They usually had a record that had come out within the past 2 years, and they were relatively prolific for a hardcore band, like you were mentioning earlier. But this record just, like, I mean, frankly, I just haven't really cared about their musical output that much. I would be like when they released, you know, the last full length, The Note, it was like, okay, that was cool. But it just kind of filed away into the memory banks. And when they played those songs live, I was like, oh yeah, I recognize them. And then when they released those, you know, series of 7 inches, which was like 4 EPs, which they tried to mimic a full length, but they released it on a bunch of different labels. Like, cool idea, but a person like I assume, such as yourself, where it's like when you're able to kind of like sit down and listen to an album, like that's exciting, as opposed to like, cool, here's another 7-inch. Let me flip it over.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's been one of my biggest gripes with like Paint It Black, which is, you know, a modern hardcore band I love. Like, I think their 3 full lengths are incredible, and they've taken to doing, you know, 7-inches instead of LPs, and that's fine. Like, I love every 7-inch, but it's like, man, I want more than like 10 minutes of new Paint It Black.
You're like, from a rational standpoint, you understand. You're like, okay, I get it. The band is busy with their own personal lives. It's hard for them to write a full length, but then we just selfishly want that.
Yeah. I mean, being a music fan is an exercise in like selfishly demanding things from someone who you have no right to demand things from.
Totally.
But like, what was your relationship with Bane? Like, are you like really into like Give Blood and like the early records that are, you know, kind of considered of the past like 15, 20 years, like modern hardcore kind of classics or touchstones?
Totally. Like, I mean, in the late 90s, when they first started to, you know, put out when they self-released their 7-inch, and then when they got signed to Equal Vision, it's like those records were huge for me, just because it was this weird conglomeration of like, okay, they are, by all definition of the term, like an old school hardcore band, but in the same kindred spirit as like, you know, what Turning Point did for me, where it's like, oh, like clearly your lyrical content can be a lot more than, you know, the cliched being stabbed in the back, you know, talking about how cool your varsity jacket is, like every cliche of youth crew hardcore. And then they tempered that, you know, lyrical styling with the fact that they also had a lot of like, you know, sort of metallic influence as well, especially early on. It just totally flipped my switch. And I just always, still to this day, anytime Bane comes through, I always go see them, because they still are vital live, and they still care, and you can tell, as opposed to just like, all right, we're just going to go through the motions because that's what we have to do. And so, yeah. And that's why this record hit me so hard, because it was like, they didn't need to put this out, you know? Like, I felt like they could have just like left and gone on a tour and did their thing and be like, that's it. But they've like all of the, you know, the interviews that they've done around this and the sort of marketing behind the record is just it's so deliberate and thoughtful. And the music just like it kind of encapsulates everything that kind of made them special to me. So that's why I chose the record, because I was like, I feel like people in the same fashion as what you were talking about earlier, people take certain bands for granted. And I think a lot of the times you have to do something quote unquote special, whether it's like breaking up or in order for people to talk about a record. And that's why I was just like, I feel like I need to say something about this, because I think a lot of people are going to be like, oh yeah, it's a really good record. And yeah, I'll see them when they come through. And then that will be all the discussion they have around it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting, because like, I feel about this as you do, but like, I have a totally different experience with that band, where like, for me, you know, I came to Bane, you know, in the early 2000s, after like some of those big records were out, and they didn't hit me the way they did a lot of other people. Like, I always respected Bane. I always felt like they were a band I should like more than I do. Sure. Where like, I would hear the records, or my friends would be into them or playing, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. And again, it would just kind of be like, oh, that's cool. And I would just kind of leave it be. But when they announced they were breaking up and like, you know, just kind of like put out like a video on YouTube kind of explaining why, I was like, it gave me this drive. Like, all right, I need to listen to that record, and I need to go back and give them another shot, because I really respected, like you were saying, how they were approaching it. It was very deliberate, and it was very much, it didn't feel like a marketing ploy. Like, this didn't feel like them trying to get people talking about Bane, but it was like they were a big important band for a lot of people, and I respect that they didn't just kind of peter out. That like, we're gonna make a record about the end of this band, we're gonna make a record that is like the capstone to everything we've done throughout our career, and like give you one last opportunity to experience this. And I think musically, like, I was really taken with it. Like, it was the most I had really been moved by one of their albums, because I think there's just so much going on. There's so much nuance and subtlety to the music. Like, at moments it's so quiet and kind of distant. At other moments, like, there are some of those metal influences where it gets really chuggy riffs going through, and they nail it no matter what they're doing. And top to bottom, I think it's an important record, because it shows how you can grow up playing this kind of music.
So well put. I look at it like this. This is what adults do. Like, when you are focused and deliberate about what it is you want to do, this is adults making a hardcore record.
Yeah,
and like you said, it's like that. This is this is where they're at in their lives, and they're just like, okay, like here's what we want to accomplish. And they, like, in both of our estimations, they did it. And it's just so, like, it does feel very, like, it doesn't feel, you know, it does, a lot of people are listening to the record having emotions of, you know, sadness, where it's like, oh, I don't know what a world is going to be like without Bane. And it's like, you know, let's be honest, it'll be fine. But, right, yeah, we'll be okay. Clearly, there'll be some cool stuff that'll come after it. But that notion of just, like, I feel like a more celebratory tone, where it's just like, dude, this is every, like, this is it. We've poured everything into it. Like, you got us. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your life.
Like, well, and that's the big thing about it, is it feels really celebratory. It's not like them down on themselves. It's not this, like, wallowing and like, oh man, we're old and we can't do it. It's like, no, we were a great band for a long time and we can still be a great band, but life happens. And it's just, you know, people always talk about how hardcore is like a young person's game. And to some degree it is, but I think this record is going to, I had to make a wild guess, just pure speculation, like 5-10 years from now, it's going to kind of be a touchstone for bands that are active right now to be like, all right, this is how you can age and still be that kind of band. And this is how you can end a band when the time's up. Like, not every, you know, breakup needs to be this explosive fall apart kind of thing. You can make a deliberate choice that is going to bum people out and probably be hard on yourself, but that's what being an adult is. And, like, that's why this record is about, and I think so beautifully expresses what it's like to be an adult and still be into youth culture. And I put, like, you know, fake air quotes around that, but, like, yeah, I mean, I just think in the truest sense of this phrase, like, I think it's an important record.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Like, this is, it's a total case study where it's like, I mean, not only can you look at this record, but you can look at what they've done musically and be like, that there's no one that would look at Bane that cares about independent music that would be like, oh, I don't know, what they did didn't seem really successful.
Yeah.
No, like, you did it. You did it from front to back, and there was no, like, there was no real huge falters in your, you know, musical career and your musical output.
Exactly. Like, even, you know, me being on the other side of this, being the asshole, was like, oh, I didn't really like Bane. Like, I never said they weren't a good band. Like, I always acknowledged Bane was good. They just weren't. Sometimes bands don't hit you. And I'm just kind of glad that, you know, even though it's their last record and it's kind of clouded in this moment, like, it's cool to finally feel like I truly get it, to feel like I truly can experience something that was always there, was always important, but I was kind of on the, you know, outskirts of. It's cool to be able to actually feel it, understand it, and, like, it makes sense to me why this was a band so many people cared about, because right now, it, you know, this record, I still really like more than the other stuff after having revisited it. But it's cool that, like, to hear a record and be like, all right, now I need to go back to this band's catalog because I think I finally get what I was missing, and then finally understood what exactly it was that, you know, was lacking in both directions.
Yeah, which is awesome that you can have that. It is, because obviously it doesn't matter when you get into a band. Like, I mean, from the, you know, the notion of the, you know, oh, the old punk rock guy of like, oh yeah, their demo was the best. Like, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, whatever you get into a band, as long as you have that connection with it, who cares? And it's awesome that you can come in the last record and be like, oh yeah, I checked it all out and I still like this last record. And it's like, no one, like, if anyone would quote unquote fault you for that, like, clearly they're stupid and we should fight them. It's great.
My thing is 9 times out of 10, and like, I am occasionally this guy, but like 9 times out of 10, the dude who's like, oh, a demo is the best record, is fucking lying to themselves. Like, you know, they're lying and trying to be cool. So I don't know. I like seeing bands who can grow and mature and change and always be honest. And that's, you know, never thinking I would, you know, be like, oh man, I really like this Bane album. I never doubted how genuine they were. And I'm glad to see that even as what they're kind of talking about and where they're at has changed, like, they've not lost that element of truth.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Well, I'm really glad that we both exposed each other to things that we didn't necessarily think of to listen to in the first place. It's awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of the beauty of, like, being able to talk about music is you'll just kind of be like, oh, have you heard X, Y, and Z? And I'm glad because, like, you know, you told me to listen to something that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. And I've come out of it like really being stoked on it. So I'm glad I could also do that in the opposite way.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, Dave, your contribution is always appreciated, and thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So there you go. I know a lot of you like recommendations of stuff to listen to, so there you go. So here's another Dave. Dave Varillin, like I said, he is the singer for Botch. He also sings for Narrows. He's done some other stuff throughout the years. I think he played in Roy a little bit, but in any event, I was so excited because through a friend of a friend, I got hooked up with his email address, and he immediately said yes. And so we started texting with one another, found an appropriate time for me to call him, and it was just great because we stepped right into the friendly joking around mode, and I think he was ready to talk about stuff because I don't think he's necessarily done a lot of interviews recently in regards to kind of Botch and his whole musical trajectory. So we talk about a lot of awesome stuff, staying involved in music and still giving a shit, as well as like the unintentional beginnings of Botch, because they clearly were a terrible band when they first began, and as most bands should be, because let's be honest. I mean, if you're in a really good band when you're like 16 years old, 15, 16, I don't think you have that cool experience of being like, oh, hey, here's my first band. It was awful. I'll let Dave do the talking. I will talk to you, well, actually longer than a minute. How about like 50 minutes? Okay, I'll talk to you after. Involved with from a musical perspective, I was exposed to you through Mike Fite. Gave me one, obviously the 7-inch that he released from you guys, and then it was one of those things where it's like it didn't click for me right away. But then when you guys released both of those 7-inches on a CD, and then obviously that the O Fortuna cover that everyone hit you guys up for years and years and years.
Yeah, exactly.
that I don't know why, but it all kind of like congealed and made sense. Like I don't know, it was weird. As this, like, each 7-inch was good, but then when you put both of them together, it just, I don't know, it made more sense, even though they, you know, I don't know if you guys felt like that at all, and that's why you obviously packaged it up, or that was just out of necessity.
No, I think we wanted to package them together because we felt that was more cohesive of like a kind of a time frame for the band, you know, and for us as people. So we were trying to figure out what it was exactly we were trying to do, you know. I mean, our goal was to just put out a record, because back then, like, putting out a record was a huge deal. It was pretty difficult. You know, it took a record label to do that. It took, like, I guess acceptance from somebody out there to like have a record out. And so we were pretty excited to try and accomplish that. And then when we kind of did the 2 7-inches, some growth, of course, had happened, and I think they're very different, especially sounding and stuff like that. But yeah. Then together, I think you're right. I think they kind of belong together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's weird because I can't think of very many other bands, especially from that era, that it was like the putting a collection of early stuff together made, you know, it kind of made cohesive sense. Because obviously it's like, you know, when you're 16, 17 years old, like, you're not thinking, you don't think of cohesion. You don't care that both 7-inches sound the same or whatever.
No.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like, maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to, like, get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
But yeah, so it was,
no, it's funny it was because I keep running into the realization that we probably accomplished all this stuff subconsciously that we didn't realize we were doing, and so now when it's under scrutiny so much, you know what I mean, from other people, is when it kind of brings it to light, you know what I mean. So
yeah,
whereas we were just trying to like practice and have fun and write songs that we thought were interesting and challenging or whatever. Or moshy, you know what I mean? This doesn't matter, but we just try to do whatever we were capable of. And then all of a sudden, we look back on it and we're like, oh man, that totally fits weird. You know what I mean?
Right, right. It's like, oh, hey, this was completely unintentional, but awesome that it worked out that way. It made us look really smart when we weren't really trying to do that.
It makes you wonder how often that's actually been the case with smart people.
Oh, you know? There's a term for it. I think I've heard it. It's like accidental genius, you know, where it's like you just... You just trip across something, and then obviously as the narrative changes as you get older, where it's just like, you know, because you could have totally just owned that question or like, oh yeah, you know, when we put out the 2 7-inches, like they made sense together. And of course, that's why we did that. Like,
right.
You just own that narrative. But yeah, that's not, you know, you're honest and that's good.
Yeah, well, I think you know, the honesty of it all is just, it's kind of prevalent in our band. You know what I mean? We kind of were just doing what we felt was appropriate and pertinent and what we wanted to do, and so all of a sudden when people were digging it, we were kind of like, okay, well, like, we didn't do anything really different in our minds, you know what I mean? It probably sounded much different to like a record buyer, but in our minds we were just, you know, these are the songs that were coming out of us. So having that kind of like real honest music coming out of us, I think, you know, had an impact on the way it was received.
Yeah, no, it's I totally understand. And this was actually a point I was going to hit a little bit later on, but I think it's a perfect time to bring up, where something that I personally noticed within the, you know, I was spent most of my time going to shows in Southern California. And so, you know, being not too far removed from what was happening in Seattle, just the stuff that I was witnessing in regards to that point you were making, where it was like, you know, you guys putting this stuff together was obviously, you know, it was all based around fun. Like, clearly there was no business plan, because bands of that nature didn't make a living. Like that wasn't even an option.
Right. Right.
But it's weird. I mean, and I think it's something that, you know, you guys did very well, where it was like, you took the music that you did seriously, but you didn't take what you were doing seriously, if that makes sense. Where like, the presentation of like, because you guys, you know, generally speaking, like in between songs and just like, obviously you as people are, you know, goofy.
Yeah.
Anytime you guys played, you know, like when I would see you, it would be this like kind of, you know, very serious, heavy, like obviously surreal experience when the band is playing. And then in between songs and off stage, you guys are just kind of like, hey, and if you ever found that rubbing people the wrong way, or they were just like, oh, I thought you were going to be super serious and like mathy.
Yeah, I think it would screw people up because, you know, around that same time or whatever, maybe they saw like, I don't know, I want to say Coalesce or a band like that, where, you know, those guys were like, fuck you, we're not going to talk to you or whatever because we're so moody and this is so serious. Or you know, Neurosis maybe even, where it's a band where you feel like they're unapproachable and they're like some kind of super being, you know, that's like putting out this kind of like experience, you know what I mean? And I think for us, like especially since we never really talked about it, we were just like, okay, let's play a show. And like, you know, we grew up on bands like the Olympia scene and like the Seattle scene, where bands like Unwound and stuff like that would just get up, be who they were, and play songs and react how they would just typically normally. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And so we kind of were closer to that, I think, than kind of like a theatrical, all-encompassing product. Like, you know, from point A to point Z, we are this moody creature that is going to create this experience for you. I think we were just more like, hey, here are the songs that we wrote in our basement, like maybe if you want to, you should dance to them or whatever you want to do, you know. And
right
I think that that was awesome for us. I look back on that as with such fondness, because I get excited that we were just true to ourselves and like kind of just let it happen, versus like, okay guys, let's sit down and talk about this now. Who's gonna wear the red, you know, shirt? And I'm gonna wear a black shirt tonight, so don't, you know what I mean, or whatever. Yeah. And like all the way to the point of yeah, go ahead, sorry.
It's calculated, where it's like, yeah, you obviously there, you know, you guys had a plan for the band, but it was there was not that deliberateness that was obviously so prevalent, especially in heavy music, where it was like you did feel like you had to have some sort of agenda, where it's like, yeah, you guys were, like I said, there was a plan, but not so structured to where it's like, oh, no deviation from that.
right. And then, you know, you'd play shows with some bands and they'd be like, you know, on stage telling everybody, all right, everybody, like, you know, this song's about this. You know, they come off as like, oh man, like these guys are so, so intelligent and so like deep thinkers. And then after the show, you'd hang out with them and be like, oh man, like that's kind of sticky, you know what I mean? It wasn't like a real presentation of them as people necessarily, or maybe it was and they just turned it on and turned it off. I don't really know, but
yeah.
I just don't think we weren't that kind of band where we wouldn't take on like I don't know what you want to call it.
Yeah. A persona, but, like, a character. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Yeah. You yourself, were you born and raised up in the Pacific Northwest, or where did you and your brother and your family come up?
Yeah. Yeah, man. We were born in, let's see, I was born in Lakewood, which is like south of Tacoma.
Okay.
And that's where we, and my brother and sister were too, but like different hospitals and stuff. But yeah, we grew up down there, and it's kind of like at the time, especially, it was kind of like an affluent suburb of Tacoma. And I guess it still is, you know, it's kind of gone downhill a little bit lately, but you know, our parents are together and had jobs and stuff like that, so we kind of just did our thing, you know, in that neighborhood. And then let's see, right when I was getting out of high school, so like 96 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
My dad got a job in Seattle and my whole family moved up to Seattle. So everybody moved up there and I actually stayed in Tacoma and was going to like community college and stuff. So
okay. But for all intent and purposes, your formative years, as it were in the Tacoma area, which for anybody that hasn't traveled up in the Pacific Northwest, it's like my first experience, like I played Hell's Kitchen in Tacoma before, and it was like,
mm-hmm.
It was so weird because you have a picture of Seattle and like that's what it is. And then you go to Tacoma, which is like totally like working class. Like it just felt so different. And it's only an hour away, you know, or even less than that.
Yeah. No, it totally is different.
I'm sure that's something that you like completely, you know, is ingrained in your DNA.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it definitely had an effect on, I think, us coming up as a band, you know. It's crazy too because like I'll be around Tacoma these days and I'll run into people that are like, oh my gosh, man, it's like cool to see you guys. Like I saw you play or whatever. And you know, you guys are awesome. And it's totally like easy to talk to them. Whereas in Seattle, you know, somebody will look at you and then they won't say anything. And then when they leave, somebody else will be like, that person was totally freaking out that you were sitting right there. And you're like, what? Like, why the fuck didn't they say anything? You know, it's just so weird. Kind of like passive aggressive and kind of, it's just a different scene. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. And honestly, I would say in the last 10 years or 15 years since I've been in a band in Seattle, that's done a lot of stuff. I think Seattle's changed. I think it's a lot more what it needs to be now. There's like an awesome kind of underground scene again. And like, there's a lot of active people in the music scene, whereas for a while I think it kind of lulled out, you know.
Yeah.
But Tacoma's great. I mean, it's the kind of place where, you know, you could be, you know, poor or you could have trust fund money and it didn't really matter because you're just sitting on the same, you know, bar stool next to somebody and
yeah.
It didn't matter, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. What did your what did your parents do for a living as they were raising you guys?
My dad is a lawyer, and my mom is a special ed teacher.
Oh, okay.
So, but she didn't really go back to work until I'd say we were all in junior high or high school, something like that. So she was an at-home mom.
Sure.
For our, you know, young days. And then my dad worked at a law firm in Tacoma. And,
What sort of law did he practice?
No, I think it was just civil case stuff. Like he didn't really share a lot of that. I got more involved with his career when he became a court commissioner, which is like a mini judge, I guess is the best way to put it. Like,
sure.
For the state court of appeals. And that was more interesting to me because he was, you know, he had a robe and he'd sit on a bench and he'd hear cases and he had a calendar of all this different stuff where he had to like make decisions on, and he was hearing all these appellate cases, like people that were like trying to, you know, like redo basically what had come of their situation.
Right.
And that was pretty interesting stuff, you know, listening to him talk about that stuff.
So as you, you know, what sort of kid did you find yourself being in the Tacoma area? Were you, you know, kind of a troublemaker? Did you kind of stick by the rules or how do you look back on that time?
You know, I mean, I think it was awesome. I kind of got away with a lot of stuff. I was just bad enough to like feel like I was free, you know what I mean? But I wasn't so bad that I didn't need jail time or anything like that. I just, I think I spent one day in a holding cell and that's about it.
And what precipitated the one day in the holding cell? What did you do for that?
So I had some older friends, of course, like you do. And we were skipping school and I think we were driving around and we'd gotten lunch or something like that. And we're driving and this car cut us off. And one of the dudes in the front seat had like a little tiny, like orange and yellow, cap gun. And he pointed out the window. Well, there was a cop behind us and he saw the shape of a gun, I guess, silhouette kind of a deal. Pulled us over, did a full like felony stop, like dragged us out of the cars. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. It was way, way overkill. But then that's the life and times, right? So
right. It's so funny because like I think every kid runs across an experience like that where it's like you're like, dude, I know it's a cap gun. Like we're fine, right? But then you realize that. But then once you actually like kind of step back and look at the situation, you're just like, oh. Yeah, I could see where someone would look at that and be like, oh, that may be a real gun. Like, that's some serious stuff.
Dude, oh, yeah, especially now, too. It just seems, you know, it seems so crazy to me then. But, like to now I'm like, oh, yeah, I could see why that would happen. And, you know, they let us just sit in this cell with, like, some serious criminals for half a day, you know what I mean? And let us kind of sweat it out for a while.
did you have to make the dreaded call to your parents to pick you up?
Dude, no, that was the crazy part. They just kicked us out of the front door, really. So then we're like, mile, and like, they let us out like an hour apart from each other. So like you're on your own. You had to find. So I think what I did was walk to the library and called my mom and said, "Hey, I'm at the library. If you want to come pick me up," and yeah,
that's it. Wow, that's incredible. They're just like, "All right, lesson learned."
Yeah, dude. Yeah, I'm not sure my pants when, especially like I was one of the last ones to come out of the car, you know, and they had you put your arms up, you know, walk backwards to my voice, you know, like yeah, like a movie. And I'm walking backwards halfway, and then all of a sudden they're like, "Stop, stop, stop, open your hand, drop what you got." And I'm like, "What the fuck? I don't have anything. Oh my God." Like I open my hands up, and I don't know if they saw a shadow or something, but
right.
I thought, oh, a bullet's going to hit me in the back right now. I'm going to get shot for doing nothing. You know what I mean? I was super scared.
Yeah. Oh, dude, for sure. You're like, this got way more serious than I ever anticipated. You're pushing the limit, but not so much as to, get your parents too worked up. Your brother's younger than you. And where does he, are you the middle child or are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest. And then Ben's the middle child. And we have a sister who's the youngest. Yeah.
So yeah, as you started to you know, go through high school and stuff like that, you know, were you into sports? Like, how did all that stuff start to you know, come in your head? And obviously, independent music. When did that start to, you know, take its hold?
Yeah, I had like one best friend, and growing up in like elementary school, I lived down the street, and basically, him and I got into sports, and like we were skiers, like big into skiing, you know, like I played soccer up until high school, and then like but we did like ski bus, which I don't know if you know what that is, but that's like,
no,
you go to the school on the weekends, and the bus, there's like a bus, and then you go to the school on the weekends, and it drives you up to the mountain, and you go ski all day.
Oh wow.
And so like, yeah, so I did that for years, and like, so I was big into like skiing and eventually snowboarding and that kind of stuff. But then as soon as I got into music, I kind of ditched sports completely. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I felt myself identifying less with the sports dudes and more with the rock dudes. And so there's like a transition right there, you know?
Right, right. When did you have, like, when you were skiing and stuff like that, was there hopes to like compete and kind of do that as a thing? Or was that just like more of a hobby than anything else?
Oh yeah, no, it was like, it was back when like extreme skiing was starting to like break in, and like dudes like Glenn Plake, the guy with the big mohawk, would ski, you know? Yeah. You ever see that guy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's a big like standing mohawk, and he's going like 90 miles an hour down the mountain. And
sure.
So we were like, that guy's awesome, you know? And we'd watch all the Warren Miller flicks and a bunch of other stuff. And
You just basically,
so we were big into that.
You wanted to be extreme. I get it.
Extreme, yeah, dude. It's funny, man. I remember a time writing the word extreme like on my binder, just being like, "Yes, extreme." You know, I'm like, now it seems so hokey, but
yeah. But dude, that's a mantra at that time. You were writing it on your binder to advertise, like, "Dude, I'm edgy. Get lay off."
You never know. You never know what hot babe might be looking over your shoulder at your peachy. Right.
It's
peachy. You're like, that dude's extreme.
Yeah. You're like, I gotta ask him out for a date. Obviously, that's incredible.
Yeah,
so then, but how did the introduction of independent music come into play? Was it like you said? Obviously, you made a transition from kind of, you know, being a sports dude into music. How did that kind of, you know, matriculate through your life?
I think two ways. Like, one is like my older friends that I got arrested with, those dudes. Mm-hmm. They were snowboarders and stuff like that, and we started listening to, like, they had like some Minor Threat and stuff like that they were listening to, and I was like, what is it? You know, like getting into it a little bit.
Yeah.
And there was like local shows around, like local punk shows in Tacoma and Puyallup, which is a town east of Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go to these shows, and I wouldn't really understand it, but like I was there and I was digging it. And then these other kids in my high school that were hardcore kids, and they were like, "Oh, dude, we listen to like Gorilla Biscuits and you know, bands like that." And freaking, there's a, for some reason that's running away from me. Oh, Brotherhood from Seattle was huge then.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, "Dude, we love Brotherhood," and they were just, you know, all about that. And so I was kind of getting into that because I was like, "Oh, these dudes are cool. They're not jocks. They're not. They're kind of assholes." Like.
Right. You hit on such an important point that I think there's something that's inherently appealing to the idea that it's like, yeah, you look at those guys and they were obviously like, they look like they knew what they were doing. Like, and that I think that's where that sort of assholeness comes into play, where it's like, oh yeah, like I'm into this cool shit. Like, where are you?
Yeah, dude. So it was crazy because I saw like a real microcosm of like the hardcore world, like occurring in Tacoma, Washington, where there was like, you know, this one dude would show up and he was in his Krishna robes, and we're like, dude, what's that dude? And he's like, he's a Krishna now. He's, you know, he loves this, this, and this because of this, this, and this. And we're like, whoa. And like, what are these dudes? And they're straight edge dudes. And we're like, oh, what's straight edge? You know,
right.
Just fell into it, you know, and all of a sudden we're going to every Undertow show, which was every weekend just about.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be driving out to Seattle or driving out to, you know, Bellevue and places to go see these bands and sitting in, you know, and we thought, dude, this is so awesome. Like, nobody knows about this. Our parents don't really know exactly what it is we're doing. We're like sitting in a city alley waiting for the door of the venue to open up. You know what I mean? With a bunch of like people we don't even know, but who treat us cool. And you know what I mean? It was just,
yeah, it's a secret.
It was intoxicating.
Right. It's that whole sort of secret society thing where you're just like, I can't believe that everybody isn't into this.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And then, so we'd be driving up from Tacoma. We'd go to this record store in Seattle called Fallout Records, and that was where you could get, you know, a lot of hardcore albums, you know, from, you know, whatever, like tons of labels with some of their stuff there. Anyway, mm-hmm. So we'd buy records, then we'd go to the show, and then, you know, then we'd go to band practice or whatever. So that was like our life for the formative years of Bosch. Like, it was just, that's what we did, like go to shows, practice, and buy records.
So was it... Was Botch, by all intent and purposes, your first band?
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
Dude, that's not very fair. I mean, because typically speaking, you got to have at least one or two other terrible bands under your belt before you really start something. Obviously that lasted for a long time. So yeah, I think you got to go back. You have to start playing in some bad bands now.
Well, I'm trying. I'm trying to start a bad band. So
exactly.
I'm going to make up for it. But, you know, I think there were some incarnations of Botch that could be considered pretty bad. Like our first year or so. And
oh yeah,
I don't know. We did like a demo tape that was like, really? Like what? Like we were some crazy cross between like Helmet and Jello Biafra, you know what I mean? Like, we made no sense. We made zero sense. We were writing these weird topics and, like,
mm-hmm.
But I think those are the years that we gelled together and grew together as musicians and learned to play our instruments and learned to, like, I mean, we were friends, so it was just that's what we did. We hung out together and jammed and stuff like that, and we always had the next thing, like, okay, we're gonna write a song, and then we're gonna play a show, and we're gonna try and play this show, and we're gonna try and, you know, put out a record, and we're going to try, you know, we just have the next thing. And
right.
So it was awesome. It was productive. You know what I mean?
Did you always have the conception that you wanted to, for one, sing in a band, and for two, like once you started to go to shows, like, was it immediate that you wanted to play in a band as well?
I think I always wanted to play in a band. I remember like I asked my parents for a guitar and guitar lessons when I was maybe 13 or something like that. And so I got that, and I was trying to do that, and I was going to these guitar lessons with the guys like, hey, you want to check out the newest Red Hot Chili Pepper jam? And I was just like, fuck, no, this guy sucks, you know. And we would be working on this stuff, and then when I met those dudes, you know, Dave, Brian, and Tim,
mm-hmm.
they were like, yeah, we have a band, man. And I was like, what, you guys have a band? That's so awesome, you know. And
right.
They were like, yeah, you know. Maybe we'll let you in our band, you know, type of deal. It was so funny. And then I remember getting the phone call in the kitchen of my house because, you know, you had a house phone back then, just one phone. And they were like, yeah, dude, so we're going to practice, you know, tomorrow. You should come over. And I just hung up the phone and was like, I'm in a band. And I ran, like, just so stoked. Like, I had no idea what I was doing, but I was just like, I'm in a band. These guys want me in their band. I'm so stoked. Yeah,
right.
You know?
Right. Like, I'm talented. I obviously will be able to deliver.
They wanted me because I had a guitar. And they were like, dude, you got a guitar. Perfect. Well, I showed up, and they were like, ah, you're terrible at guitar, man. I don't think you should touch the guitar anymore. So
that's amazing.
That didn't last very long.
I think that's such an important part of the formation of bands is like so many people end up doing what they do in a band just either by default, by like you said, by them owning an instrument, or usually the vocalist for the most part isn't because they're good. It's just because he's loud maybe. Like, oh, I think he can, that guy could probably pull it off.
It's true, man. It's totally true. I had a few conversations with John Pettibone from Undertow and IMSA, you know, and
yep.
and we would talk about how, you know, he was originally the bass player in Undertow, and then their singer quit or something like that, and they're like, well, who's going to sing, you know? And he's like, I guess I'll do it, you know, or whatever. So
yeah,
it totally is like that, where you just kind of fall into that role.
Right, right. And so as you started to go to shows and start the early years of Botch and stuff like that, how did your I presume your brother was obviously starting to see what you were getting into, and how did your parents start to react to that stuff, as they were like, oh great, not one of my sons but both of my sons are getting into some weird looking stuff?
Yeah, you know, I never really got a negative impression at all from my parents. I think that's
good.
Like probably the one is, yeah, I'm so lucky in that regard. In fact, like, my dad was like, oh, great. Like, would drive us to these shows, or would drive, do all this kind of supportive role stuff for us. It was really awesome. In fact, like, I think Botch's first ever tour was, we played 3 shows in Canada. We played Vancouver, Victoria, and then this other small town outside of Victoria. And my dad drove us for the whole tour for like 3 nights.
Dude, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And like, he had his van, and he would drive us to the show, and he would just sit in the van, and he'd let us unload, and then he'd be like, all right, I'm going to go back to the hotel or whatever. I'll pick you guys up at 1 in the morning or something like that. And so he would drop us off at like this house overrun with like punk kids, and he would just let us do our thing. And I feel so lucky to have had parents like that, that really like just let us like kind of find our way,
Yeah, no, that's such an incredible story of hearing not only like, dropping you off at shows, but clearly like taking the next step and being like, hey, I'm involved in this. Like, and having my presence here is helpful.
Totally. I mean, I'm sure they saw it as like, hey, well, at least we can keep an eye on them a little bit.
Sure.
And make sure, they're safe and stuff like that. But also for us, it was just like a huge boost in like, in confidence and support. And so like, whether it was like our parents, like helping us buy equipment or taking us places, like that's the kind of stuff that, you see like a lot of these, like, I want to say urban bands, and they're like, I came up on the streets or whatever, and like nothing was handed to me, but like so much creativity and music comes from the burbs, like where I did, where that's like where it's cultivated. You know what I mean? That's like where one of the places where it's, you have situations like that where it's totally supported, and everybody, your parents want you to do something with yourself and creative or whatever.
Yeah. And I'm sure you had this experience as well when you tour. It's not so much the big cities that you have great shows, from like LA to New York to Chicago or whatever. Like, shows will be cool there. But then it's like when you kind of, step off the beaten path and you play, like suburbs of these big cities, some of those shows are just like, dude, there's 200 kids here freaking the fuck out. And like, why? This is great because it's the birds.
Yeah. Yeah. Or college town or something like that, where all these students are, and they like, they're interested in what's going on. And I always felt like a weird, there's kind of like a weird, like, shame associated at the time. Like, yes, so what? So my parents are dropping me off at the show. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'll be driving soon or whatever. You know what I mean? But now looking back, I'm like, man, there's nothing to be ashamed about. That's like,
it's amazing.
That's like where a ton of these bands come from. I would argue that the majority of them, I mean, who at 15 has enough money or wherewithal to get a instrument? It's very, very limited, very few. So
totally. No, that's,
you know,
that's,
I don't know.
That's rad. That's rad.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
I definitely attribute this to my own personal naivete, but you guys definitely were one of the earlier bands that I noticed that wasn't straight edge, where it was like, because that was obviously such a thing in the 90s where it's like, oh, you're playing hardcore, you know, at least 3 out of the 5 members are probably straight edge, or there's some affiliation with that. But then I just remember seeing you guys play, and it was like, oh, like clearly that's not on their agenda, and that was fine. But it was just that veneer of kind of like, oh yeah, like quote unquote normal people can play this style of music too, even though by definition you're not normal because you're playing this weird music. But so did people have that common interaction with you guys where it was like, oh, so how many of you are vegan straight edge?
Yeah, well, it's kind of weird because me and Tim, the drummer, we definitely at early stages we said we were straight edge. You know what I mean? Like we X'd up and we listened to, you know, all the straight edge bands and we totally adopted that culture. But it didn't last long, and I think it's mostly because, to be honest, we didn't fit in with those dudes like with the straight edge scene that much, and I don't know why necessarily, but like in Seattle or the Northwest, it was kind of like a kind of macho scene, you know, with like a bunch of really good looking dudes who were like 6 skateboarders and, you know, had a trail of girls following them. And, you know, that's the straightest dudes were.
Right.
And so like, it didn't take long for us to realize, okay, this isn't really who we are. This isn't really working for us. I mean, I don't drink, but I'm not going to wear wife beaters, and I'm not going to, like, you know, only shop at Champion stores and stuff like that. You know, so it didn't last long. But I mean, we'd run into that a lot, and we'd play a lot of those bands, and we'd run like play those venues or like a straight edge house, you know, a bunch of straight edge kids were living and stuff like that. And what made it kind of easier is that we weren't like, you know, lighting up a cigarette in their face or anything like that. And you know what I mean? Like we're just neutral. We're just pretty neutral dudes.
Yeah. No, there was a respect across the board from, you know, all of those elements coming into play. And the other thing that obviously I know a lot of people spoke about when you guys started to incorporate, like a light show, and, you know, that pervaded throughout the, you know, the rest of the band's career. Was it one of those things, like when you guys, because I mean, to be honest, like there wasn't very many bands that were doing a version of that, usually because it's expensive. I mean, and it's a pain in the ass because stuff breaks all the time. Obviously for you guys, it was an important part of just kind of, you know, creating an atmosphere, I presume.
Absolutely. I'm sure we stole it. I'm pretty positive. I wish I had a better memory. I'm telling you, if I can talk Brian Cook into finally publishing his tour journals, we'll probably find out where we stole it from. But
until then,
I can't remember. But it was definitely that kind of thing where we're like, I remember I was kind of experimenting with singing through like this weird combo amp that we had that had a reverb tank on it. And so I was like messing with a bunch of like vocal, you know, sounds and stuff like that, and having sound guys mic it or run a DI on it and just be irritated as fuck at me. And then I think it slowly morphed into, okay, these cheap work lamps from Ace Hardware, let's plug them in while we play, and that way the light is on the crowd instead of on us, you know what I mean? And they're like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, cool, you know? And it just totally grew, you know what I mean? Just like everything else we did, it just developed into what it was. Yeah, I love it though, man. It's one of my I was really stoked about the lights and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, it was always cool because, I mean, the last time I saw you guys play, I think it was when you came through with Rocket from the Crypt and Murder City Devils, I think, and you played at like the El Rey Theater. And it was one of those things where it was like, it was even cool that, you know, watching you guys in front of, 300 people at the Shea Cafe was great and the lights provided an environment. But then obviously when you guys were doing larger tours, you still were able to kind of like blow it out and still create that atmosphere, which that's hard to do, obviously, but it provided that general like that through line throughout the band where it's like, oh no, we're trying to control this.
Totally. It was so funny because every time we would set up on a stage like that, like El Rey or like a bigger like Great American in San Francisco or places like that, we'd have these like pro stage dudes looking at our shit like, what the fuck? I'd be running an extension cord across the stage and plugging in power strips. That's what our switch system was a bunch of power strips,
Right, right. What are you doing? Like, this is a fire hazard times 10. What are you? It's amazing.
Yeah. I was like, what plug has a separate circuit than the music? And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, because we blow a lot of fuses with like this. They're like 500 watt halogen bulbs or whatever strewn across the stage and whatever else we had, strobes and shit like that. And
right, that's incredible.
But the best thing about it was, then we'd go to Europe or we'd go to Hawaii or places like that, and you could just go to the hardware store and get all the components for our light show. You know what I mean? And just if something broke, it costs like $20 to fix instead of like $2,000.
Right, right. Yeah, which is incredible. And so obviously as the band started to, come to a close and you guys obviously, you went out on a proverbial high where people were still wanting more music from you guys. But, for you yourself, like once you started to confront the idea that it was like, oh, wow, like here's, and not like you were ever, or I'm just presuming, but did it ever come to a point where obviously you guys, like you were making all of your money off of the band and you didn't need to hold jobs and stuff like that?
No, we never reached that point.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, no, we were always like coming home from tour broke and like pissed off. And going back to work at the auto parts warehouse or, wherever.
Right, right.
So it's like you said earlier in this conversation, like bands back then just weren't making money off of doing music. And I don't really think anybody's ever, besides like, the mega stars, I don't think anybody really makes a ton of money off of doing music. It's more labor love than anything else.
And, right, right. I always look at you're never making money, but there comes a time where it's like, obviously a band becomes self-sustaining to where it's like, yeah, you can take those 2 months in between tours off to where you're not having to work a crappy job or whatever. But yeah, obviously that, you guys never got there. But so I'm sure when the band started to come to an end, was it kind of a terrifying screeching halt for you to be like, whoa, where do I go now? Where do I pivot? Like, what do I do? was there a lot of that?
Absolutely.
In your
head? Yeah. For me, especially because I didn't have another project. You know what I mean? Like, Dave was, and Minus the Bear and stuff was totally ramping up. And I think Brian was such a talented dude. It was just a matter of time until he was doing something with somebody. But I think for myself, and I know for Tim, like we were just kind of like, well, that was fun while it lasted. Like that was our music career. You know what I mean? And that's when I started like, okay, I need to like figure out what I'm going to do to make money for the rest of my life and face the music kind of a moment,
Was it difficult for you to make that transition, not only like mentally, but, kind of figuring out what you wanted to do?
I had a pretty good idea, actually, like towards the end of Botch, I was working on becoming a fireman, and so that's what I just decided I was going to pursue full time, And
yeah,
so that's what I did. And then, but it was bittersweet, like emotionally and mentally, it sucked. You've been on tour before, so you know how after you home from tour, you have this like week of just depression, like
yeah,
because you're at home and you're seeing the same, scenery for 24 hours or more.
Right. Well, it's the adjustment period. It was always one of those things where it was like, it definitely, usually a significant other is able to notice it where like they know that they need to kind of, leave you alone for, whatever, the 3 to 4 days after you're home because, you know, you don't wash the dishes. You're just like, well, that's because you didn't have dishes for like 2 months. Like, these are just certain, there's a weird things, but yeah, that sort of transitional period.
Yeah, so I think I had one of those that lasted about 2 years.
sure.
It's a, where I missed it. I missed music, and I missed at least having like kind of like that other side of my life to like look at and like look forward to and stuff like that. So it was a bummer.
How did you find yourself kind of, you know, making that transition in your head to where it was like, okay, I need to let go of that idea. And I am obviously focusing on, you know, becoming a fireman. And like, that is, you know, that's now my focal point, as opposed to, you know, trying to put another band together or something like that.
I think it was just that. I think it was just having that as a focal point. Like, I think I just decided, okay, well, now that that's done, I'm not going to like, you know, I don't want to spend like 1,000 hours in like a dirty practice space, again, necessarily, right. At that point in time. So I was like, I'm going to focus on this, and I'm going to try, I can to like, you know, I spent all my time on that. I did a bunch of work and testing and whatever else. So, you know, it kind of just took away the emptiness of not having a band, but really that never fully went away.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, it's like once you, and I think a lot of it has to do with just the general concept of kind of creating something out of nothing. Like that's, you know, that's a very, once you've done it a few times, it's like, oh wow, that is such a gratifying feeling that it's difficult to, you know, duplicate in other facets of, you know, quote unquote uncreative life.
Absolutely, man. And like that's why, you know, like Rob Moran, man, he's kind of like the guy that saved me, dude. He's the resurrector, because I was doing nothing, and he moved up to Seattle and totally was like, dude, let's jam sometime. And I hadn't even thought about doing it, you know, ever really. I'd done Roy, which was more like fun hangout with Brian and my brother.
Right.
For a good time and excuse to hang out and stuff like that.
Right.
Which now I look back on and I fucking love all those songs. Every single song Roy ever did, I fucking love. So
dude,
awesome,
Roy was one of those things too, where it was like, you guys were definitely a few years ahead of the curve, so to speak, or it was like, you know, it was right before, you know, the idea of like, you know, like Lucero and a lot of obviously like the sort of, you know, alt country stuff that was happening within the punk scene. And it was like, yeah, you guys are just, you know, a few years ahead of that, which obviously, you're just good at being ahead of the curve, I guess.
Dude, I don't know if that's good, man. Have you ever gone surfing? If you're ahead of the wave all the time, you never fucking get to catch a wave. It sucks.
Totally. But you're able to look at the wave and be like, hey, that was cool. Like that got built off of me.
That's right. Almost, man. Next time I'll get it.
Next time. So when did you, cause you have a family now, you have a child and, you're married currently.
Yep. I got a kid, daughter and wife and a rabbit and a house.
when did that all start to, was that towards the tail end of Botch when that stuff started to come into play, or is that well after?
Well, it's after. I got married, after Botch, right when Narrows was beginning.
Okay.
And then that marriage fell apart.
Okay.
And so then I got remarried 4 years ago. Actually, I didn't get married 4 years ago, but I found my wife 4 years ago.
Sure.
Then I got married, then had a baby. And so this is like the second go around of the whole marriage game. But
sure. Second time's a charm.
Yeah, dude. The first one's a practice. You got to get out of practice.
Right. The training wheels.
Exactly.
And so obviously it's one of those things now. It's like that clearly takes the priority in every aspect of your life. And obviously, you know, you're creative in the times in which you can obviously find the time to do it. is it one of those things too that where, you know, when you go out and obviously play shows with Narrows and stuff like that, and, you know, do participate in that creative process, is it more difficult to play for kind of unresponsive audiences, kind of people that are just like looking at you being like, oh, what's happening with this band? Is it more difficult to do that now, or is it more difficult to do it kind of, you know, back then when you were playing in front of, you know, 20 people that could care less?
Man, yeah, that's a good question. I would say now, because I've played in front of people that have gone nuts, you know what I mean, and had a great time, and it's been an amazing, like, energetic show.
Right.
So maybe I have an expectation or like an understanding of what it could be. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so then when I play a show and it's like, you just get a bunch of stares or whatever, or people sipping their drinks in the front row, you're just kind of like, oh man, like this is not what I thought it would be, or right. This isn't what it should be. And so it's a little tougher. But then again, I'm older now. So I'm like, yeah, I get it. You guys don't want to, y'all got to go to work tomorrow. You spent $10 on that drink. You don't want to spill any of it.
It's weird too, because I mean, I think once you're able to have that perspective too, you also, you know, look at maybe what's happening within the context of whatever you're consuming from an entertainment purpose. Like you yourself, you have to travel, you have to spend time away from your family and all the other things that obviously, you know, give you happiness in your life, to play in front of 40 and different people in New York or wherever the hell you're playing. And then you're just like, I'm spending time away from this to do this in front of you. Like, just show me a little bit of something.
Right. Yeah. No, I've felt that a few times where, afterwards I'm just like, what am I doing? You know, we're out here in the middle of Arkansas or someplace. And I'm like, this is going to suck. There's nobody here. There's no pre-sale at the door. Like
right.
The venue has like a leak in the roof. Everybody's sick or something like that. And I'm just like, what am I doing? And then, you know, like for a great example, the last time we played Arkansas, then like 150 kids show up and they totally enjoy it, totally go crazy, buy a ton of merch or whatever. And you're kind of like, oh, okay. Like now I'm reinvigorated and I understand again and I feel good about it.
Right. Yeah.
Or you play a great show, you know, and you just have a good time with your buds and you make lemonade out of a bowl of lemons. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think two last things I wanted to hit on. The concept of obviously like, you know, being a fireman, I know that runs in your family. So that's obviously why you kind of chose to, pursue that. It's always one of those things too, where, you know, when you hear people that are obviously in notable bands within the punk and hardcore context, and then you hear obviously like what they do afterwards. And so it's like, it totally was obviously it was the truth, but it was the narrative where it's like, dude, you know, Dave broke up Botch because he wanted to be a fireman. He wanted to save people. And it's like, did you hear any of that chatter from that perspective where it's like, wow, dude, you're a fireman. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, I got a couple comments like that where people were very interested or like, you know, I think, but it's common, you know what I mean? To get that, like, oh, you're a fireman? Like, what's the gnarliest thing you ever saw?
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? Or,
sure.
So you get that a lot, but it's also cool in the hardcore scene or music scene when it's like people are genuinely interested and it's not like, oh, you're not in a band anymore, but now you have a record label, or you're not in a band anymore, but now you tour manage, or, you know what I mean? Like, kind of like parlay
right.
your career in music. Versus just going into something completely different. And so I enjoy talking about it to people or whatever. And I think a lot of people are interested in it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, for sure. I like that perspective of like, you know, taking a complete pivot away from something that you were so involved in. Because obviously it's like you still participate and you still remember it. It's not like, you know, you became a fireman and you eschewed your entire past and are just like, oh yeah, I was never in any of that.
Right. No, it's funny, like to this day I'll be at work and dudes will be like, man, so we were looking at some YouTube video of you like over in Belgium, like, wow, dude, you know, or they give me some looks or some right. like, that was a really scary video you made where some girl's ripping her face off, and what was your inspiration for that? And I'm like, dude, I didn't make the video, man. I just wrote the song, dog. I don't make the video.
Yeah, that's incredible. Where it's like the you know, they know you in one context, and then seeing you outside of that in another context, they're just like, whoa, Dave's into some weird shit, man.
Yeah. Dude, are you into heavy? Are you a metal band? Or, cool. So you're like Goo Goo Dolls, man? That's awesome. And I'm like, no, I'm nothing like the Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah. Sorry, dude. We're not alternative adult rock.
Yeah.
And so the last thing I want to hit on was just the general, you know, you yourself, obviously, like, there's every reason for you to not be, you know, from a real life perspective, there's no reason for you to obviously still be quote unquote involved within obviously the context of Narrows and still paying attention to music in general. You know, what obviously has kept that interest alive inside of you? Because obviously, as you, I'm sure you can point out in a lot of, you know, people that you've known throughout the years, you know, there's, you hit that, you know, that 25, 26 year old wall, and then all of a sudden they just drop everything and they just don't really pay attention to music because it doesn't resonate with them anymore. Why does it still resonate with you?
Man, that's a tough question, because it's actually a lot of work, you know, to try and stay pertinent, I think, when it's not like your daily life. Mm-hmm. At least from my position, it is. My wife, I'm lucky enough, she's a huge music fan too, and so we listen to records and talk about records and stuff like that a little bit, but it's really difficult. Like, I just was kicking myself, was it last night? No, 2 nights ago, because I missed the Russian Circles Helms of Lee show.
Oh, yeah.
With that tour here in Seattle, and like Ken Mode was playing, and these bands are awesome bands that I really want to see, but I just got other shit, man. And like, you just kind of got to accept that that's one of the ways it goes, I guess, where you get to buy some records and, you know, read some interviews and stuff like that online, but you don't necessarily get to take every weekend and go do this. And I guess the reason is just because you kind of have an addiction to it, I guess. I don't know. I just have always loved music in that way. And I like trying to stay current with what's new, but it's fucking hard, man. I have a really hard time with it. That's why I have friends like Rob Moran. I'm like, dude, what are you listening to right now? You know, or Fredrickson or any of those guys. I'll just be like, what have you guys been buying? Like, let me listen to your phone or whatever, because for me, it's pretty difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, but just the active step of you wanting to do that obviously shows that there's, you know, you're not forcing yourself. You're just like, you obviously, like you said, there's not enough time for you to dedicate to that. So you're able to kind of lean on your friends to do that, which is awesome. So.
Yeah. And like, the best part is I'll just hit up the dudes from Hydrohead and be like, hey, send me some releases. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if I make them feel bad enough that they actually send me some records and
right.
I get to listen to some new music.
You're like, hey, in the form of any back royalties owed, just send me some new records. We're cool.
Yeah, seriously. You can take this $23 back, and instead I'll take 6 LPs.
So you're the you're basically the reason they went out of business. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, dude. I ruined Hydrohead. I ruined Initial Records. I'm sure I ruined.
That's true. Fueled by Ramen too, right?
Yeah. Oh, Fueled by Ramen. Yeah, they went under fast. That was easy.
That was easy. Well, I really appreciate you hanging out, Dave, and I had a lot of fun with this, so thank you. So there was Dave, and thanks to Dave. I really appreciate that. He didn't need to accommodate my pestering, but he did, and that was great, and you benefit from it. So the producer of our show is Tom Richfield. I love him so much. I use the words love in capital letters, L-O-V-E. Oh, so much love. Anyways, visit propertyofzach.com, visit 100wordspodcast.com, email the show, follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook. Just do everything with the show. That's all I ask, you know? It's a pretty simple ask, right? Anyways, the rest of this month, we have some awesome, awesome guests. Like I was saying, the theme is pioneers, luminaries within the context of punk and hardcore. Next week is Justin Pearson from The Locust, All Leather, Retox. Basically, he's done a ton of stuff. Super interesting guy. And then wrapping up the month is Sean Ingram from Coalesce. So, man, for those of you that were involved in sort of mid-90s to late 90s punk and hardcore, this month is made for you. So anyways, until next week, be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.